that has jurisdiction to decide the disputes over genocide. South Africa, as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, like Israel and all other countries, we all have an obligation, a binding obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent the crime of genocide and to punish it. The other very important consideration that we took into account was that Israel itself is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and by its signature, it has consented to the jurisdiction of the ICJ over the disputes related to to the crime of genocide. And we as South Africa, by virtue of the fact that we also have an obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent that crime, we do not need to be a party to the current conflict that's going in there. So we have what lawyers call locus standi in the ICJ, and therefore that gives us you know, that opportunity or that privilege to present this case on behalf of the Palestinians in the ICJ.
And by the way, you know, we remember that after the Rwanda genocide, the world said never again, and it's happening again, unfortunately. In its ruling, the ICJ issued interim orders that the Israeli regime must you know, take measures to prevent genocide. But I think the regime is intent on continuing its genocidal war backed by the U.S. And, you know, we have seen what is happening in Rafah. So what's your take on this? I mean, it's total impunity on the part of the Israeli regime.
That has been our experience with the apartheid government in Israel for a very long time. They have acted completely with impunity, and they have enjoyed political, diplomatic support and cover from their some of their partners in the West. And that has been quite unfortunate. Now, these provisional measures that the court has ordered, and we must be very clear, those provisional measures are binding on Israel, and they are binding on all of us as far as our obligations to prevent genocide are concerned. So the fact that the court has ordered these measures, there is also a corresponding obligation on all of us to ensure that Israel complies with these orders. For instance, it was really disappointing to see, particularly after the provisional measures were ordered, to see Israel's partners continuing to support Israel through provision of arms. And taking actions like withdrawing funding from UNRWA, the consequence of which is that it will perpetuate the genocidal decision on the part of Israel to starve the people of Gaza of food, medicines, and other essentials. So Israel is under an obligation to comply with this, with these measures. And the rest of us must ensure that Israel complies with this, and that we do not take actions that will continue to perpetuate the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza.
Members of the U.S. Congress have called for, you know, like a review of South Africa-U.S. ties because of your country's stance at the ICC. And, you know, South Africa is resisting and has that resolve to move on. So what do you view all these threats? Have you received other, you know, like threats to downgrade ties or, you know, to pressurize you to withdraw from your support for Palestine?
Yes, we have seen, and you are referring to the United States, we have seen pieces of legislation that have been proposed in this context, as you say, to review our bilateral relations with the U.S. Well, we don't know exactly what that means. But the U.S.'s own internal legislative processes, those are processes over which we have no control whatsoever. But what I will say, Mubarak, is this, that our decision to take this route is informed by the principles, the norms, the values, the standards that underpin our engagement with the world.
Yeah.
At a multilateral level, at a bilateral level.
Yeah.
And we, in our foreign policy, we are very clear. We are informed by principles such as respect for human life, multilateralism, the desire to have international relations governed by pre-agreed rules, as opposed to international relations being governed by a brute military and economic and political power.
Yeah.
We believe in a system of international relations that respects the rule of international law, that seeks to resolve pressing political conflicts through peaceful means. And we wanted to, in order to ensure that we can live by these principles, we want to ensure that those institutions of global governance, like the United Nations, and those instruments of international legal systems, like the human rights legal systems, international humanitarian law, and all this, that we can use this and rely on this to address the problems that we face in the world. And our approach through the ICJ is simply our desire to work within an agreed framework or so. So if other countries think that we shouldn't be doing that, or that if we pursue that that route, we need to be punished, well, it is something that over which we have no control. But what we know that we are fortified in our approach.
Yeah.
It's a principled approach that we're taking.
Impressive.
And this is the correct way of approaching it.
Now, and this brings in the issue of double standards, you know, within the international system. You know, like during this conflict, Ukraine-Russia conflict, we've seen the ICC has issued, you know, arrest warrants or summons against Russian President Vladimir Putin. But within 3 or 4 months, the Israeli regime has killed 30,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. And no warrant of arrest has been issued against the Israeli regime's Prime Minister Netanyahu. What's your take on these double standards?
Mubarak, my brother, you use the term double standards, and you are absolutely right to characterize how some of these international rules have been applied. And that is unfortunate, because we cannot have a system of international law that applies or uses different rules and criteria for some and a different set of rules for the other.
Yeah.
That will simply breed contempt for the rules of international law. That
Indeed.
Will only bring this global system of rules into disrepute.
Yeah.
And it doesn't augur well for the global community going forward.
Yeah.
So it is regrettable that some of these institutions of global governance, and you have referred to the ICC, that in the case of President Putin, and now in the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu and some of the leaders of the apartheid regime in Israel, different set of rules are being applied.
Exactly.
And that is unacceptable. We must have a system of international law that applies to all, because international law must be applied without fear, favor, or prejudice, equally so, and that way you can inspire confidence in these rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if we continue to operate on the basis of these double standards, we will not do any good to the international system as a whole.
Yeah. Now, Israeli regime officials have accused South Africa of working closely with the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, and even say that South Africa is the legal arm of Hamas. What's your take on these claims?
We heard that that was one of the first accusations that Israel made when we took the case up to the ICJ. Mm-hmm. And well, that is in the strategy of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. Those that it doesn't agree with, it mm-hmm. will always label them. In our case now, we have been labeled as the legal arm of Hamas.
Yeah.
We have been labeled anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, and, mm-hmm. and all this. And this is a strategy that they use to delegitimize, to pour scorn mm-hmm. over the principled course of action that that we have mm-hmm. we have taken. And these insults, really, and these labels are usually the refuge of someone yeah. who does not have a case.
Yeah.
And therefore, these don't mean anything to us indeed. And I imagine that we are being labeled the yeah. legal arm of Hamas because in the eyes of Israel, Hamas is a terrorist yeah. organization, so it is regarded. But we do not regard Hamas as as a terrorist organization, indeed. And we find those labels and comments mm-hmm. to be utterly preposterous.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has also been at the forefront of rejecting attempts by the Israeli apartheid regime to infiltrate the African Union. And the last attempt, two Israeli regime's officials were actually ejected from an AU summit in Addis Ababa. Can you now consider, following this genocide in Gaza, can you now consider that that case is closed and the regime will no longer be considered even for being an observer member of the African Union?
The issue of Israel as an observer in the AU is an issue that our leaders still needed to discuss at the summit level.
Yeah.
However, from South Africa's point mm-hmm. of view, we are very clear.
Yeah.
We will oppose any decision, any application that seeks to admit Israel as an observer in the AU.
Yeah.
And the events since October last year, the genocide that Israel has carried out against the people of Palestine, is in fact another solid reason why Israel's attempts to be an observer in the AU ought to be rejected.
Rejected, yeah. Now, we have seen many countries have expressed support to South Africa's case against the Israeli regime at the ICJ. Now, how will this impact on South Africa in terms of global geopolitics?
Well, yes, we have many countries have expressed support for South Africa going forward, mm-hmm. which we appreciate, mm-hmm. Of course, and which I think the people of Palestine appreciate. As to how this will impact on geopolitics, I guess the jury is still out there.
It's unfolding.
Exactly. But for us, we have this case to prosecute, mm-hmm. We think we have made a very strong case going forward.
Yeah.
We have now passed the provisional measures, and we are glad that at the end of the submissions that we made on the 11th of January, mm-hmm. When other countries had labeled our course of action as meritless, as baseless, as without any basis whatsoever, the ICJ agreed with us mm-hmm. by and large.
Yeah.
And we ought now to be moving into the merits stage. And for us, that is what we are focusing on. What are the implications and the broader geopolitics of that mm-hmm. would be? We'll mm-hmm. leave that to others to deal with.
And now, and even the fact that many state and non-state actors are supporting South Africa's bid, do you think there will be changes in the international system of justice, that there'll be more focus, people will have some hope on this international court of justice and even the ICC? Are we going to see an evolution towards more trust to these institutions?
From where I'm sitting, Mubarak, my brother, yeah. I think that this case has awakened mm-hmm. the conscience of ordinary people mm-hmm. On Main Street. Mm-hmm. And these protests that we have seen across the world, yeah. from Cape Town to London, then from Washington, D.C. to Sydney. Ramallah, mm-hmm. to all over,
yeah.
the ordinary people on the ground, through their various formations of civil society, mm-hmm. have taken this issue mm-hmm. upon their shoulders mm-hmm. and they are putting pressure on their governments
yeah.
to do something about the genocide in Gaza. The ceasefire now, the calls for the ceasefire, the calls for mm-hmm. Humanitarian aid, and the calls for holding the apartheid government yeah. in Israel accountable.
Yeah.
All this is important and it's a positive development because ordinary people on Main Street now realize that these commitments to international law, international principles yeah. ought to be implemented.
Yeah.
And I think if anything that will come out of this, it is that positive reawakening of the people on the ground.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, BRICS recently expanded to include more countries, including Iran, and it's emerging as a major force globally. What do you think, what role can BRICS play in resolving global conflicts like the current genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, BRICS is a grouping of mostly developing countries yeah. from the south.
Yeah.
And we have common objectives of pulling together our resources to develop our countries, our economies, to yeah. develop our people, and to foster greater cooperation and collaboration amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. And therefore, our cooperation mm-hmm. is in many fields mm-hmm. of economy, of politics, of culture, science and technology, and so on and so forth. And we also seek to adopt common approaches
yeah.
at resolving or addressing questions such as the conflict in Gaza. So BRICS becomes one of the important formations of the countries of the South to deal with all these challenges yeah. that we face today.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has been at the forefront, of resolving the Palestinian issue, and there have been so many proposals, there have been talks and negotiations that have failed because the Israeli apartheid regime has failed to implement its commitments. And there's now this proposal, for example, Iran is proposing that one of the main ways of resolving the Palestinian conflict is through having a referendum that will involve all original inhabitants of Palestine, be they Jews, Christians, or Muslims, and even a referendum that will involve all Palestinian refugees who are scattered across the globe. Do you think this is a good solution? What's your take on this proposal to use a referendum to resolve the Palestinian issue?
Yes, yeah, so many proposals have been made about how to resolve the question of Palestine.
Yeah.
And we respect the sovereign position that the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken.
Yeah.
And, we cannot contend, we cannot argue with that. It's a sovereign position
yeah.
of the Islamic Republic. But the important thing is that that proposal is also aimed at finding a durable, yeah. lasting peace for the people yeah. of Palestine. And we acknowledge and we appreciate and we endorse the principled support that Iran has provided to the people of Palestine. And it is part and parcel of that global effort yeah. to find accommodation and a solution to this.
Mr. Ambassador, our last question. The South African Parliament took a very decisive decision for, recalling or the cutting of ties with the Israeli regime and the ejection of the Israeli ambassador from South Africa. And we've seen South Africans have also come out massively, you know, to express support to Palestinians. Can you tell us more about this, the reason why South Africans are also, the people of South Africa, have come out, you know, to express their support to Palestinians?
Yeah, first of all, yes, as South Africa, we support fully the struggle of the people of Palestine,
yeah.
And the people of South Africa on Main Street supported that. However, I will say that, yes, it is true, we have recalled our ambassador from Tel Aviv since, I think, 2018.
Yeah.
We have recalled all our diplomatic staff in Tel Aviv, and we have also closed our embassy there. And it's not that we have cut diplomatic ties,
yeah.
as such, ties as such, but we have just closed our embassy in Tel Aviv, and it was a very clear decision on our parliament, which was also followed by the executive decision, that one of the reasons why we decided to close that was to ensure that we could force in one way or another the issue of the ceasefire. But if I may just say pretty briefly that, you know, South Africa, we are the beneficiary of one of the most coordinated, solid international solidarity movement since the Second World War, the anti-apartheid movement.
Yeah.
And we think today there is a need to revive that spirit of that
solidarity.
Global anti-apartheid movement in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
Yeah.
And we need to be looking at what measures we can take to put pressure on Israel. And if it means severing diplomatic ties, imposing arms embargo, boycotts, isolation of the apartheid regime there, these are all peaceful measures that we can take. They have worked in the case of South Africa, and they can work in the case of Israel.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Francis Moloi, for your time today.
Thank you, Mubarak. It was a pleasure indeed to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray protesters on pro-Palestinian marches as extremist and outrageous and dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. British ministers are considering proposals to ban MPs and councillors from engaging with groups such as the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Extinction Rebellion, and Just Stop Oil. The plans put forward by the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, say mainstream political leaders should tell their representatives to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop hate on marches. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, are due to discuss the proposals as part of a review conducted by Woodcock, the former Labour MP who now sits as Lord Walney at Crossbench Pier. The Prime Minister was condemned by human rights groups for warning of forces trying to tear us apart during a hastily arranged address in Downing Street recently. He was charged with exaggerating tensions at protests after he warned of mob rule in Britain. In an article in the Sun newspaper, Lord Walney wrote, "My review on political violence is about to be formally submitted to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary. In it, I'm asking the leader of every mainstream political party to take a zero-tolerance approach to the threat that is threatening our democracy." Lord Walney added, "So Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer should instruct their MPs and councillors not to engage with anyone from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign until they get their house in order and cut the hate from their marches." The proposals are politically convenient for the government because, if accepted, they would put further pressure on the Labour leader Keir Starmer over his party's stance on pro-Palestine demonstrations. Several sitting Labour MPs have attended Palestine's Solidarity Campaign events, including the former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, and the MP for Poplar and Limehouse, Absana Begum. Labour has refused to suspend MPs who have attended events despite demands from senior Tories, because the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is not a proscribed organisation. The Conservatives have previously engaged in talks with Extinction Rebellion, including the Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove, whose department is working on the definition of extremism as part of its brief. Ministers are looking at broadening the new definition to cover groups that officials claim their actions undermine the UK's institutions, as previously reported by The Guardian. While Environment Secretary in 2019, Michael Gove met Extinction Rebellion and said afterwards he shared their high ideals to tackle the climate crisis. Labour leader to allow Labour representatives more freedom to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza. After George Galloway, emphatic by-election victory in Rochdale, where 18% of the population is Muslim. Many within the Labour Party believe it points to anger felt by Muslims over the party's position on Israel. A shadow frontbencher questioned whether the Labour leadership had gone far enough in dispelling false narratives on pro-Palestine marches. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. A British government advisor on social cohesion has described attempts to portray pro-Palestine protesters as extremists and dangerous and outrageous. Dame Sarah Khan, who is carrying out a review of the resilience of the UK's democracy for Michael Gove, said such claims risk further dividing the country. Hundreds of thousands of people have been regularly massing on the streets of London to protest against the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli regime. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has described the demonstrations as hate marches, and the government's Commissioner for Counter-Extremism, Robin Simcox, wrote in the Daily Telegraph recently that London had been permitted to be turned into a no-go zone for Jews every weekend. Speaking to the Daily Mail, before Robin Simcox's comments were published, Dame Sarah Khan said she believed the United Kingdom had a problem with extremism, but that people should be careful in their language. Dame Sarah Khan, who was Simcox's predecessor as the government's counter-extremism commissioner, said, "I think it is really important that we don't conflate those protesters, somehow saying or portraying them as somehow as being all extremists." She added, What I've been really uncomfortable with over the last couple of weeks is a kind of argument that they're extremist on these demonstrations. I think that's actually outrageous. Dame Sarah Khan was appointed as an independent advisor for social cohesion and resilience in 2022 and is expected to complete her review this month. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has not gone as far as some within the Conservative Party in criticising the marches in London, but he has recently warned against the protests. Jonathan Hall KC, the government's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, warned, however, against attempts to curtail freedom of expression and freedom of assembly on the basis that it might make some parts of society unhappy. Every week, tens of thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators protest in Britain, condemning Israeli crimes in Gaza. Recently, hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestine protesters staged a fresh march against Israeli crimes in London, demanding a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The demonstration, which was organized by UK-based advocacy and Palestine action groups, was one of the biggest pro-Palestinian marches held in London. The procession followed the main roads in central London to reach the Israeli embassy. The protesters responded to calls for a third Global Action Day for Gaza, demanding world leaders take immediate action to stop the massacring of innocent civilians in Gaza. Demonstrators held placards reading "Ceasefire Now," "Free Palestine," and stopped the genocide. Around 1,500 police officers have been patrolling the area and are said to be keeping marchers away from the Israeli embassy in London. The British Law Enforcement Agency claimed a demonstrator who was seen in the crowd with a placard was arrested for inciting racial hatred. Police officers then made 10 further arrests during the incident at Hyde Park Corner, bringing the total number of those arrested to 11. A number of further restrictions are being implemented by police during the protest. Meanwhile, similar marches were also held in other major cities across Europe, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Majad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of God, I mean Ramadan, and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, somebody asked, my gums often bleed and the blood gets mixed up with saliva sometimes. At times, I'm not sure whether the saliva that enters my throat is mixed with blood or not. What's this situation? Is his fast valid, Sheikh Javid. Would you please enlighten us regarding this individual's situation?
Well, if the blood from the gums dissolves in the saliva, dissolves means that it disappears once it gets mixed with the saliva. It disappears in such a way that it seems to be non-existent at all. And what is seen is saliva, not blood. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is actually called dissolution of the blood into the saliva. So the saliva actually is pure and it can be swallowed. And swallowing the saliva, no matter how much the quantity, will not affect the fast. And in such cases, actually, the fast is valid and there's no objection to it. And if you are not sure, as you rightly mentioned, whether the saliva is mixed with blood or not, again, it can be swallowed without any problem, without any objection.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, you know, we all know that as Muslims who fast, it's always advisable to clean your mouth with any means possible, whether it is brushing your teeth or any way possible, so that there wouldn't be any residue of food in your mouth when you're fasting. So if somebody forgets to do so, I mean, forgets brushing their teeth, then there is always the risk of this bits of or tiny pieces of food in their mouth to be swallowed, all right?
Yes.
And if they do so, even unintentionally, how should they go about this? Should they offer the qadha of that day because they, ate maybe some pieces of food?
Sure. Well, there are some details which I would like to provide for our listeners. First of all, brushing the teeth is allowed in and of itself, as long as you make sure that no paste, no actually foreign ingredients go into your throat.
Yes.
You make sure and then you brush your teeth, keep your teeth clean, there is no problem. But when it comes to the bits of food remaining in between your teeth and you want to actually throw it out, but okay, you unintentionally end up swallowing it. According to His Eminence, it is said that if you did not know that some bits of food remain between the teeth,
mm-hmm.
he says,
okay.
and you did not know that they would reach the throat and they were swallowed unintentionally and unknowingly actually, then you are not liable for any qadha. You do not have to make up your fast. Because first of all, okay, there were some bits of food, but you did not know it, okay? Or maybe there were some bits of food and you knew it, but you unintentionally, you swallowed it. So your qadha, your fast is not invalid. And there's no need to make any qadha. What is forbidden is actually to intentionally and deliberately and knowingly swallow the tiny bits of food that remain in between the teeth.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back to continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javid. the gums of a person, Sheikh Javid, who's fasting, bleeds a lot, all right?
Yes.
Well, does this invalidate this individual's fast?
Well, as we discussed it earlier, probably in this episode or maybe in the previous episode, you know, the bleeding gums does not invalidate the fast unless the blood is swallowed. Okay, if you do not swallow the blood, or maybe if the blood is mixed with the saliva and the blood stains disappear because it is dissolved in the saliva, of course, in such a way that there is no there are no traces of blood seen, then the fast is not made void.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What about pouring some water over one's head? Does this invalidate one's fast?
No, it does not invalidate the fast because it's not considered to be a kind of immersion underwater. Everybody who performs ghusl, maybe during the day, they have to pour water on their head to wash it, to use shampoo and then pour water. And pouring water does not actually in any way affect the fast, unless you want to immerse your head underwater, which is something else. It's a different issue.
Yes.
Immersion makes the fast void, immersing your head underwater.
Mm, I see. Okay. Well, there are certain medicines, Sheikh Javid, for feminine illnesses that are usually applied through the vagina. Does their use invalidate the fast?
Well, the use of such medicine does not invalidate the fast, mm-hmm. no matter, because it's taken vaginally, through the vagina.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And His Eminence states that it does not affect the fast, no matter what it is.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, would you please explain to us or to our dear audience your view and opinion on having injections while fasting during this blessed month, I mean Ramadan. Do injections basically invalidate fast?
To be honest, this is a very important question and very much frequently asked by by mu'mineen across the world. They keep wondering whether injections affect the fast or not. According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it is based on obligatory precaution. For the fasting person, ihtiyati wajib, for the fasting person to avoid having any kind of supportive, nutritional, or intravenous injections, okay,
mm-hmm.
as a measure of obligatory precaution. So the same rule is applied to all kinds of intravenous fluid, infusions. And a fasting person should avoid having such kind of injections. And I should say that the scholars, the religious authorities, differ in their opinions when it comes to the injections, the shots they take during the month of Ramadan. According to some scholars, all kinds of injections are allowed.
Mm-hmm.
whether they are nutritional or they are actually sedative.
How interesting.
Yeah, they are. They do not affect the fast. But okay, when it comes to Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion, may Allah grant him long life, he's of the view that, okay, one should avoid having nutritional injections while fasting. But when it comes to non-nutritional intramuscular injections, like for example antibiotics, okay, and painkillers, you see, anesthetic injections, they are allowed because they are not nutritional.
I see. What about pills, like for example for high blood pressure?
If taking these pills during Ramadan is necessary for controlling high blood pressure, of course, it is permissible, but it definitely invalidates the fast because you take it, you take it through that through your throats, and it's not a form of injection or something. Okay, pills always make the fast wider, and the religious authorities are actually unanimous in their opinion when it comes to pills.
So what happens to these people? Should they like offer the qadha of the missed fast? Because obviously their blood pressure is high, so they have to take it every day.
You know, blood pressure may be kind of fluctuating. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. If they are confident that their blood pressure will not go up while fasting, okay, they should fast and take the pills sometime before before dawn or after, you know, the iftar time, if it is possible. If not, if they are supposed to take the pills during the day, they have to go ahead and act according to their doctor's advice. And of course, when it comes to qada, they have to observe the qada whenever it's possible in the following months. When the days are shorter, of course, they, or maybe it's colder, and when it's propitious in terms of taking the fast, they should do so.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, as the host of this program. And on behalf of the rest of the crew here, we bid you farewell and say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, concerns have grown among parliamentarians and human rights groups regarding Britain's arms sales to the Israeli regime amid the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. A recent notable development further established the British government's complicity in the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, as the UK High Court dismissed the case calling for an immediate halt to British arms exports to the occupied Palestinian territories, despite the massive outcry. Although British arms exports criteria prohibit licensing if there is a clear risk of a weapon being used in serious violations of international humanitarian law, the court overlooked these standards by rejecting the legal challenge mounted by the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq and the UK-based Global Legal Action Network in December. Shawan Jabarin, Al-Haq's general director, understandably slammed the legal verdict. Jabarin said the government's decision to continue supplying Israel with weapons to continue its military aggression against Palestinians of Gaza is effectively arming Israel to completely decimate the Gaza Strip, reducing Gaza's vital civilian infrastructure to rubble. In their effort to challenge the court's decision, these organizations sought a judicial review of the Rishi Sunak government's export licenses for the sale of British armaments to Israel. The legal challenge shed light on the British government's license for the sale of British arms to the Israeli regime across various categories, including components for military radars, targeting equipment, combat aircraft, and naval vessels. The Campaign Against the Arms Trade research reveals that since 2015, Britain has licensed approximately £472 million in standard arms exports to the Israeli regime, along with 58 unlimited value open licenses. Lacking transparency and permitting unlimited quantities of arms being exported to Israel. Britain's High Court's dismissal comes on the heels of the International Court of Justice's recent order for Israel to take measures to stop its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. The International Court of Justice's interim ruling on South Africa's genocide case against Israel stated that Israel is plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, triggering global pressure on governments across the world to halt their arms exports to Tel Aviv. According to multiple reports, the British government has ramped up arms exports to Israel in recent months to meet the growing demand amid the genocidal war in Gaza. The British government, led by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, is following in the footsteps of Washington, which has pledged $14.3 billion of military assistance to the Israeli regime. The website warchild.org.uk has also covered the same story and tells us more. Concerns have grown among British parliamentarians and human rights organisations regarding Britain's arms exports to Israel. Tens of thousands of innocent Palestinian civilians have been massacred since 7th of October when Israel launched its brutal war on Gaza. The civilian infrastructure also lies in complete ruins in Gaza. Some members of the British Parliament have expressed worry over the violation of international humanitarian law through their government's arms exports to the Israeli regime. The Scottish Nationalist Party, SNP, has urged the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to put an immediate end to export licenses to the Israeli regime and refrain from granting new ones. Human rights groups in Britain have specifically called on the government of Rishi Sunak to halt its arms exports to Israel, citing concerns about potential war crimes against Palestinians. In December, a letter from a consortium of rights groups highlighted Britain's contribution of approximately 15% of components in the F-35 stealth bomber aircraft used in the bombing of the Gaza Strip. The letter read, "Britain provides approximately 15% of the components in the F-35 stealth bomber aircraft currently being used to bomb Gaza, including the rear fuselage, an active interceptor system, ejector seats, aircraft tires, refueling probe, laser targeting system, and a fan propulsion system, adding that the British-supplied components had been utilized by the Israeli regime in previous wars as well, notably during the 2008-2009 war in Gaza. Citing a 2014 review by former British Prime Minister David Cameron, the letter noted, "The commitment to suspend existing licenses for equipment and parts used by the Israeli military if significant hostilities resumed in Gaza." It also referenced international and UK laws, including Articles 6 and 7 of the International Arms Trade Treaty, as well as the UK's strategic export licensing criteria, requiring the British government to halt arms transfers if a substantial risk of serious violations of international humanitarian law or human rights legislation exists. The letter documented unlawful attacks by the Israeli military on various civilian targets since 7th of October, including medical facilities, residential buildings, evacuation convoys, bakeries, water and electricity infrastructure, schools, and the United Nations facilities sheltering displaced Palestinians. The letter asserted that intentional or reckless attacks against the civilian population constitute war crimes. It noted with concern the Israeli military has also used white phosphorus munitions in Gaza, a densely populated area which puts civilians at unnecessary risk. The British government's claims of not providing lethal military equipment to Israel since the start of the war in Gaza in early October are contradicted by a January affidavit filed at the UK High Court. The Department for Business and Trade identified 28 current licenses and 28 pending applications for exporting equipment, most likely to be used by the Israeli occupation forces in their offensive operations in Gaza. 8 human rights groups, including the Campaign Against the Arms Trade and War on Want, pointed to a discrepancy between the government's public stance and the court document, urging clarification on how it ensures weapons licensed for export have not reached Tel Aviv since 7th of October. The human rights groups highlighted concerns about transparency and the British government's clear disregard for mounting evidence of serious violations of human rights law. The group said in a letter sent to the government's publicly stated position on weapons licenses to Israel is difficult to reconcile with what the government had admitted in litigation.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as